The Right to Question is supported in part by the Paul Allen Family Foundation, by Humanities Montana, and by listeners like you.
What is a bullhook? A bullhook is a device used to control elephants. The closest thing I can compare it to is a fireplace poker. It's got a sharp end, and it also has a hook. And it's been used for thousands of years to dominate and control and punish elephants. A handler will use a bullhook to literally poke an elephant in a really sensitive place or hook her in a sensitive place, under her ears, in her ears, on her trunk, which is very sensitive, under her arms, up under her tail. That gets an elephant's attention really fast.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a program that features authors from the Western U.S. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Carol Bradley about her book titled The Last Chain on Billy, How One Extraordinary Elephant Escaped the Big Top. So just talk a little bit about why you wanted to write this book.
I grew up in Kingsport, Tennessee. And in 1916, a circus elephant who was being paraded down Center Street wound up killing her handler in front of a crowd of people. The man had poked her with a bullhook one time too many, and she threw him down and stomped him to death. And my grandmother was 16 years old at the time, and she witnessed this. Now, this wasn't something she talked about very often, but as a child, I was really confused about why an elephant who ought to be really happy to be in the circus was angry enough to kill someone.
In order to control an animal as large as an elephant, the training has to begin when they're very, very young. Billy didn't go into the circus until she was 10, but a lot of elephant babies begin training very young, right?
Right. A baby is taken early, tied up, kept tied, taken out, you know, had ropes put on all four legs, pulled down to the ground. It's not pretty.
And when the elephants are in the wild, they live in family groups?
Yes. They're very, very familial. A baby elephant will stay with her mother, her aunts, her sisters, and her cousins. Male elephants tend to wander off and be by themselves and occasionally join groups after they're in their teen years. But those female elephants will stay together their whole lives.
And I noticed in the book, because there were various scenarios in which Billy found herself that involved other elephants, she did tend to bond with a couple of elephants. It was like she was trying to create her own little family group.
Right. For all those years she traveled with the circus, she was part of a five-elephant troupe called the Hawthorne Five. And they were quite accomplished. They could do a number of stunts. And Billy surely got to know the four other elephants who were part of this group. She and another elephant named Joyce were the most technically proficient of the elephants, and they could do the most incredible tricks. And so I'd like to think she and Joyce became friends. And then later at the sanctuary, she developed and still has a very strong bond with two other elephants named Frida and Liz. They're just inseparable.
What's everyday life like for a circus elephant? Let's take a year. What happens in the course of that year to an elephant like Billy?
Well, these elephants stay on the road almost all the time. That was something that surprised me when I began researching the lives of circus elephants. We kind of assume that they perform in a circus for a couple of months, and then they get most of the year off in some big field that they can wander. But in truth, they are kept in chains almost all the time, often hobbled, you know, one front leg chained, the opposite hind leg chained. They travel in semi, you know, the back of tractor trailers. They are, you know, lined up with very little room to spare. They don't have the chance to interact with one another in a natural way. They can't really wind their trunks around one another, except maybe the elephant next to them. They are constantly being handled and told what to do on circus time, not their time. They're yelled at, they're beaten, often gratuitously. The beatings are just a part of their lives. Billy came in for beatings more than most because she just had a reputation for being defiant. When they're not on the road performing, they're often kept in a barn, still tied up, getting very little exercise. An elephant in the wild will walk anywhere from 7 to 30 miles a day. These elephants don't really get to walk at all except from the tractor trailer into the arena and back out again.
And that causes a really big problem with their feet.
That's right. Elephants' feet are like, they're kind of like little waterbeds that they walk around on. And in the wild, they would be walking on fairly soft surfaces, and all that walking would keep their nails trimmed and in good shape. When they're standing around on concrete, or in the back of a truck or the back of a railroad car, they're often standing in their own feces. Their nails become cracked. They get infected. The infection works its way up into their body, and it literally kills them.
And tuberculosis was also a problem in the elephants that you researched.
That's right. Elephants can contract tuberculosis from humans, and they can give it back to humans. And in the herd that Billy was a part of, all 16 of those elephants were exposed to tuberculosis. Some of those elephants died from it. Joyce, her teammate, for lack of a better word, died of tuberculosis at a very young age. She was about 26 years old.
Billy's owner did not rest his animals during the off-season. He trucked his animals to Marine Land and Game Farm in Niagara Falls, Ontario, you found out, where they performed 6 times a day, 7 days a week. And then when they weren't performing, they were chained in a barn. Why did being a leased animal make life even more dangerous for elephants like Billy?
Well, like you said, Billy was leased. She was owned by a man who lived outside of Chicago, still lives outside of Chicago. And he didn't own a circus himself. He would lease his elephants and his 84 tigers out to circuses. When an elephant or a tiger is out away from the eye of the owner, you don't know what's happening. You have handlers handling those elephants who don't have that much investment in them. And the stories are numerous of these elephants being neglected and mistreated. And it's not a happy story.
Several places in the book you mention that elephants don't forget cruelty that's been done to them. They either find a way to express it inappropriately and they kind of wait for that moment, or else it's just bottled up inside. In what ways did you find that that manifested in the elephants that you did research on?
Well, I was really surprised to learn how violent the history of elephants in this country is, because that's right, they don't like these tricks that we think they like performing in the circus. We like to think they like them. They don't like being chained up, and they do remember who has been most abusive to them. And there are tons of stories of elephants who bottled up that rage and finally just lost it, went berserk, killed their handler, killed an innocent passerby. And in the early days, when circuses were able to import elephants to this country, if they had what they called a bad elephant, they would often punish the elephant to death because they knew they could get another one from overseas.
That isn't true anymore, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But what does the USDA have to do with elephants, and how does that connect with wildlife protection?
Well, we have an Animal Welfare Act in this country that supposedly provides minimal standards for care for animals. It's not very well enforced. There aren't enough federal inspectors to do the job properly. And even when they are doing the job properly, it's not against the law to use a bullhook on an elephant. It's not against the law to keep an elephant in chains. So it's kind of a weak and useless law, in my opinion.
You cited many lawsuits where the USDA was involved, and almost always they ended up with just very small fines that were deferred. You know, it just didn't seem like they had any kind of leverage.
That's right. And the circus industry is very strong. Ringling Brothers makes $100 million a year off its circuses. They want to protect the right to have wild animals in their circus. And so far, they've succeeded. Although, I will say that the U.S. Department of Agriculture did finally decide that John Cuneo needed to give up all 16 of his elephants. And that's how Billy finally got a new life.
But before she got a new life, she spent a long time in a really bad situation.
Right. After 23 years of traveling and performing, she did attack a couple of trainers. She never killed anyone that I could ascertain, but she did have a reputation for being a little snappy, as one of her trainers would put it. And so the Department of Agriculture ordered her owner to take her off the road. And she spent the next 11 years in a dark barn in a small pen outside of Chicago.
11 years.
Yes, it's hard to imagine.
It is. A lot about this book was heartbreaking, but I think it's an important book because people who want to go to a circus and think this is a good way to spend their entertainment money should know what's going on behind the scenes. One of the arguments that's often made by circus and zoo owners is that captive animals give people opportunities to learn about them. But again, your research didn't really support those claims.
Well, when people see elephants and other wild animals in an unnatural environment, they tend to expect these animals to do unnatural things. The two people who started the elephant sanctuary, Carol Buckley and Scott Blaze, noticed that in zoos, kids would want to throw rocks at elephants. They would want to know if they could ride the elephant or could it perform tricks. They wanted their handler to turn the elephant around so they could see them. You know, at the elephant sanctuary, there are now 14 elecams, as they call them, set up so that you and I can get on our computer and watch these elephants out in a field doing what elephants do naturally. It's a lot more fascinating to watch.
Yes, than trying to get an elephant to turn around and look at you. But the children and the people who were expecting those tricks, what else would they think if that's the only exposure they've ever had to an elephant is one in a circus?
Right. And I have to admit that even 10 years ago, I was sort of keeping track of the circus controversy. But the circuses would say, look, these aren't weapons that we're using against elephants. These are guides. They enjoy going into the arena and performing. And it almost does look as if an elephant is smiling when they're out standing on a tub, standing on their head. I sort of bought into that too.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Carol Bradley about her book, The Last Chain on Billy, How One Extraordinary Elephant Escaped the Big Top. If you'd like to hear this program again or share it with a friend, you'll find audio online at mtpr.org/twq. There's also a link to it on our Facebook page. After a short break, we'll be back to find out why it's so hard to prosecute circus owners who allow abuse of their animals. Don't go away. mentioned a few things that happen with elephants because they're not really built for standing on their heads or standing on their trunks or standing on one leg on a tub or doing any of the tricks that they're taught to do. Sometimes they suffer physical problems later because of this.
Well, there was a trial against Ringling Brothers a few years ago, and some of the testimony in that trial spoke to the fact that elephants who are constantly made to stand up on their hind legs can wind up rupturing their uteruses. They can develop arthritis. They can do tremendous amount of leg damage when they're trying to balance 8,000 pounds on one leg on a tub. Think about it. It's not natural.
I am thinking about it. It's awful. One of the statistics that your research brought to light was, as you mentioned, the Ringling Brothers Circus, $100 million a year in profits. And with that kind of money at risk, the owners of circuses, the big ones, have taken really drastic measures to counteract the efforts of animal rights activists and journalists. And I'm thinking in particular of Janice Potker. Tell us about her.
Well, Janice Potker was a freelance writer living outside of Washington, D.C. And a number of years ago, she wrote a magazine article for Rigardi's Magazine, which was a local magazine. It's now defunct. But she wrote a profile of Irving Feld, who had bought Ringling Brothers from the Ringling family. And she mentioned a couple of things that Irving's son, Kenneth Feld, who now owns Ringling, did not like. Irving Feld was deceased at that point. And so she found out later on, years later, that Kenneth Feld hired some goons, basically, to try to ruin her life. They tried to introduce a man to her that would break up her marriage. They had someone befriend her and try to find out what she was going to do with this information. She wanted to write a book about the Ringling family, and they hoped to get her off on another book topic. It was really incredible the lengths they went to vindicate that story.
Didn't they even find a publisher to offer her another book deal?
Yes.
Did I read that right?
Yes, you did.
They took out a full-page ad in the New York Times.
Well, Ringling has, they have an incredible PR machine. And anytime someone comes after Ringling, they go back, they're very proactive about defending the status quo. And they have done a pretty masterful job of painting anyone who protests the conditions at a circus as a right-wing, fundamental, radical zealot. And, you know, the public seems to buy that. But I just think that's ill-informed because the people who protest the circus are on the side of right. And they're starting to make inroads, I'm happy to say. But really, it's kind of astonishing that in this day and age, knowing what we know about elephants, knowing how sensitive they are, how intelligent they are, that we continue to allow this sort of treatment to occur.
Animal rights activists and the FDA and people involved with the Animal Welfare Act have all tried to bring lawsuits against people who train elephants for cruelty. And they've been doing this for decades. Why hasn't it gotten anywhere?
Well, that's such a good question, Cherie. Part of the problem is that in this country, you cannot sue on behalf of an animal unless that you can prove that you personally have been injured as a result of their suffering. That's almost impossible to do. I mean, there is the Animal Welfare Act. If an animal is visibly wounded and someone can witness it, sometimes you can go to court based on that. That too is hard to prove. But this whole personal standing issue is a huge hurdle for animal welfare groups to cross. There was a lawsuit against Ringling Brothers 2 or 3 years ago. It went on for 6 weeks. It took 10 years for that trial to even go to federal court. And the animal welfare groups lost because of a technicality. The judge said the key plaintiff, the human plaintiff, really did not have personal standing. And yet, tons of scathing information came out about the circus industry, but much of the public is convinced that Ringling won the case because they really didn't mistreat their animals.
But there was video. There were eyewitnesses, and elephants are still out there performing in the circus. Is it because of all the money?
I think so. It also depends on who's running the U.S. Department of Agriculture. In the last few years, Ringling has been fined $270,000 for mistreatment of its elephants, and that was the largest fine they've ever faced. And smaller circuses have also been fined, but I think paying the fine is part of doing business for them. They want elephants to remain part of the circus. And until the public says, you know, they really don't have to be part of the circus, circuses are pretty fascinating with just human performers. Nothing's going to change.
And we should say that the Ringling family no longer owns Ringling Brothers.
Yeah. That's right.
Are you worried about what will happen to you now that this book is out?
Well, I'm not going to say I'm worried. I don't lose sleep. I feel as though these companies who have engaged in sort of undercover activities to try to defame their protesters have been exposed for these acts. And I would like to think they've backed away from that tactic. You know, as James Baldwin once said, you can't fix it until you face it. And once I started learning the truth about elephants performing in this country, I just felt a need to tell Billie's story, tell the story of the sanctuary where she now lives, which is such a wonderful, magical place. And I realized that tens of thousands of Americans already know about the sanctuary and the other sanctuary in California, the Paws Sanctuary. These are tremendous places. They are huge. They have room for so many more of these captive elephants. I'd love to see them all go there.
What are the challenges for those facilities, besides the obvious one is that they have to go out and raise money all the time?
Well, these elephants tend to suffer from PTSD from all their experience. And sometimes they arrive and they don't quite know what to make of all this freedom. And they have a lot of bottled up anger that has to be vented somehow. When Billie arrived with the seven other elephants that the sanctuary got from John Cuneo, these elephants had kind of a honeymoon period for a couple of weeks, and then they started getting into a lot of scuffles. They just would fight with one another. They just needed to unleash all these emotions that they hadn't been allowed to express for so many years. And Billie was really rattled by all this behavior. She separated herself from the herd. She climbed a hill, and that's where she would stay. She'd look down on these other elephants, but she didn't want to be part of that for the longest time.
Well, let's hear a short reading that tells about what happened to Billie when she got to that sanctuary.
Okay, well, this was February 2006, so it was a little cold. And this is the first morning after Billie's arrival. And a caregiver has opened up the barn door and beckoned her out. And she does step outside.
We should say that this is in Tennessee.
This is in Tennessee. This is in Hohenwald, Tennessee, which is about 90 miles southwest of Nashville. The chilly air may have stopped her, or maybe it was the view. Before her spanned a gently curving meadow bordered by endless acres of forest, an ocean of green that stretched so far it seemed to blend into the sky. To her left, a pond the color of champagne glimmered in the morning light. In the distance, she could see five of the hawthorn elephants making their way down a dirt path toward the trees. The air smelled bracingly clean, the fresh scent of pine trees slicing through the cold. All around her was a calming stillness, no circus clangor, no announcers bellowing, no brassy music blaring. The only sounds piercing the air were the gentle voices of the caregivers and the chirps and whistles of the other elephants, otherwise sweet silence. Overnight, Billie's world had been transformed. Instead of a tiny corral barely large enough to turn around in, she would spend the rest of her life in a veritable Eden, 200 acres, her part of the sanctuary, of natural habitat filled with pine and hardwood forests, dirt trails, ponds, and most of all, space. It was almost unimaginable, the vastness of space that was suddenly available to her. Space to wander, to lose herself in. Enough space to heal spiritually and reclaim her untamed self. Billy seemed immobilized. She stared, unblinking, at the expanse of nature before her. Minutes passed as she drank in the view. Then she turned her back to the vista and faced the barn again. She milled about the barnyard the rest of the day, within sight of Frida and Liz, but some distance away from them. In the face of this brand new world, she seemed to want the company only of herself.
What result do you want to see in the world because you wrote this book?
Well, I'd like to see the chains come off of every elephant in this country. There are hundreds of them left. It's illegal to import elephants to the U.S. now unless there's a dire circumstance. So we have a stagnant population of aging elephants who are still having to go out and perform because there's not any younger elephants on the bench, or there are very few of them. But this is an archaic practice. And I think if people just understood what really went on behind the scenes, they would agree. And they would say, we're not going to support a circus that has wild elephants and tigers and any other wild animal in their act. Let's take the chains off all these animals and let them live out their lives in a much more natural environment. They deserve it. The internet has brought our world so much closer. We can sit in our homes and see what's going on in the rest of the world. We don't have to travel to a zoo or a circus to see an elephant. We can get on the Elephant Sanctuary's Ellie cams and watch them playing in a pond, throwing dirt on their backs, sitting on one another playfully, having fun. It's pretty fascinating. I do it all the time.
Carol Bradley lives in Great Falls, Montana. There's more about her and a link to the Elephant Sanctuary Elecams at our blog, mtpr.org/twq. You'll also find links to that information on our Facebook page. Thanks for listening. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you a pile of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, with help from Barbara Thoreau and Kim Anderson. Michael Marsalek, executive producer. Beth Ann Ostein, studio engineer. The Right Question has a Facebook page, a blog, and a podcast. You'll find links to all that at mtpr.org/twq. Thanks for listening and for supporting this program.